In 1968, a totally original cultural item appeared. It owed something to old-time catalogs, perhaps akin to the Farmer's Almanac. Its style was funkily lo-fi, while its content had one foot in a simpler past and the other in a high-tech sci-fi future. It was called the Whole Earth Catalog and subtitled Access to Tools. Today's guest was its founder, editor, and publisher. And were that all he'd done, Stuart Brand would have made his mark in a very big way. But Brand has been at the founding of several other cultural entities, events, and movements. Today, in his 70s, Stuart Brand is no less curious, no less purposeful, and no less forward-looking. He has just written a new book, Whole Earth Discipline, an eco-pragmatist manifesto, which confronts the challenges we face as a global civilization, population, urbanization, resource depletion, peak oil, and most profoundly, climate change. By issuing challenges of his own to what has passed for years as environmental orthodoxy, Brand characterizes many in a movement that he helped to create and inspire as being anti-science and anti-intellectual in their opposition to GMO foods, geoengineering, nuclear power. 40 years ago, Brand could say in the Whole Earth Catalog, quote, "We are as gods, we might as well get good at it." Today, in Whole Earth Discipline, he says, quote, "We are as gods and have to get good at it." Stuart Brand is the founder of the Whole Earth Catalog, co-founder of The Well, co-founder of Global Business Network, co-founder and co-chairman of the Long Now Foundation. He is on the board of the Santa Fe Institute, maintains connections with Electronic Frontier Foundation, Wired Magazine, MIT's Media Lab. He's the original editor of that Whole Earth Catalog, but he's also the author of The Media Lab, Inventing the Future at MIT, How Buildings Learn, and The Clock of the Long Now, Time and Responsibility. His newest book, as I said, is Whole Earth Discipline, an Eco-Pragmatist Manifesto. Welcome, Stuart Brand.
Well, that's quite an intro.
Thank you. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. And you write in something that I read, "What do I usually do? I find things and I found things." Now, how is it that you do that? When did it start? What is it about you or your path in life that leads you to do that? And is it still happening?
It's probably curiosity. It's a little bit of training I had was as a journalist, and so you're always looking for news. And the other aspect of being a journalist is you don't stay in any particular area very long. You're always moving on to some new domain of curiosity. So I keep looking. And then what I do with these things is I put them together, basically compile them into things like the Whole Earth Catalog or this book I just finished. And likewise, I collect people the same way and put them together. And everything from the TRIPS Festival back in 1966 to a lecture series I run in San Francisco now.
And the Global Business Network Book Club?
Global Business Network Book Club and Global Business Network itself, which is we do scenario planning usually by bringing in people way outside the industry that we may be working on to just get broader thinking. So throwing ideas, people, and tools together, that's what I do.
And in the mid-60s, you hung out with Ken Kesey, the Merry Pranksters, the early acid tests, organized the TRIPS Festival, as you said, in San Francisco. Now, how did that sort of cultural play fit in with the rest of your work?
It just had to do with, I think, you know, I went to Stanford in the 50s, graduated in 60, went off to the Army, came back to the Bay Area. Drugs were starting to happen in an interesting way then. Ken Kesey was being, in some ways, the most creative with that. And it was all the, you know, mid-peninsula domain where a lot of stuff was going on. So you can see a book by John Markoff called What the Dormouse Said, which, you know, the rest of that is Feed Your Head, about basically a lot of the origins of the computer world in the counterculture of the mid-peninsula. And because I was there, I was in the thick of that.
And but my question is, not just the drug part of it, but the cultural part of it. In other words, there aren't that many people, I don't think, who do entities like a Global Business Network, books, but who also have done happenings, events, that sort of thing. And as I look at your bio, you're full of both of those. That's not a journalist.
You're right. And I can't explain it. I'm a biologist first, and then an Army officer later, and then all these other things as well. I really wasn't planning to do it at the time, but I just kept piling skills up. And then, you know, you keep trying to find ways to use all the skills at once, design and all these other things. And I guess what happens then is you take that set of things you know how to do and try to find new things to apply them to.
Okay. Okay. And one of these things where they all seem to come together in a way is in 1966, when you conceived and actually sold buttons which read, "Why haven't we seen a photograph of the whole Earth yet?"
I think it's fair to say that I did sell them. It was not a money-making business. They were 25 cents a piece. They probably cost me 10 cents a piece to make. But, I was trying to tap that deep American paranoia to, why haven't we seen a photograph of the whole Earth? You know, it's 10 years since Sputnik, 10 years since Vanguard and all that. And a button turned out to be, at that time, a very nice portable coin of an idea. So I could send them in the mail to senators and their office workers and to people at NASA and to the various heavyweights in the Soviet Union at that time who were involved in all this. So these things percolated what we would call virally now. And I ran into people years later who had come across the buttons, come across the question, who were in the thick of the space program.
And the upshot of it?
The upshot of it was, I don't think A to B cause-effect, but when we started getting serious photographs of the Earth from space, mainly from the Apollo program in 69 and 70, I may have had a little bit of the framing of expectation that something peculiar was going to happen when we had those photographs. And indeed, it did. There's a rather wonderful book called Earthrise that chronicles how in the next few years you had five major global scale environmental organizations form, Friends of the Earth. And just that it was called Friends of the Earth bears relation to that photograph. You had Earth Day the following year. And since the environmental movement came together as a movement, I think in direct response to that photograph, I did not take the photograph. All I did is suggest it was going to be important.
Yeah. And of course, it was the cover of the Whole Earth catalog.
Well, that was. I think people kind of expected from the title of the Whole Earth catalog that I was going to cover the whole Earth, and actually it was just pretty much California and maybe North America. But with the new book, actually, with Whole Earth Discipline, I really mean it. It is about the whole Earth. It's not just the image this time.
You have a presence, TheEdge.com, and a long-time relationship with its founder, John Brockman. If this site is new to listeners, and my guess is it's new to many of them, how would you introduce them to it?
The Edge is an online version of a literary agent John Brockman's reality club, which he formed years ago. His view is that scientists are the ones who are constantly reinventing reality. And the reality that basically is, you know, the agreement that we sort of share of how the world works. And he represents the largest stable of scientist writers in the world. And one of the things he does is gets them to interact with each other personally and in terms of their ideas. He did that in direct events in New York for a long time. And then when online came along, he made it happen online, and that's Edge. It's a marvelous place to go to see basically scientists talking at the level, at their peak level to their peers, but often outside their own specialty. And so they have to, you know, explain themselves this way they don't need to with the people they work with all day. And as a result, it's wonderful conversation to listen in on. And one of the things you see is the scientists themselves, their ideas start to move as they interact with each other. And then out of that, John gets great books. We all get great books. I wound up dedicating this new book to him because I think he's so productive in that
way. So that's TheEdge.com. And the books that have come specifically out of that by Brockman, like The Third Culture and like The New Humanism and so on, are really, if you're still into books, they're a wonderful way of capturing what goes on at The Edge. And it's that thing that I love about them, which is that he interviews someone. Mm-hmm. At the end of the interview, you get reactions from a bunch of other scientists, and so it's a conversation that you get to be part of, which is out of this world.
I love the conversation that scientists have with each other, which is both friendly and rough at the same time. It's friendly personally, usually, but very, very rough in challenging each other's ideas. Personally, I would love to see environmentalists have these kinds of conversations more often and in public. I think one of the peculiar things left over from that unity that we got with the Whole Earth Image is that there's this one movement. We're all in it together, a little bit of a lockstep of we're all against this and for that. And I think things are getting peculiar enough now we need to move more toward more debate.
Mm-hmm. I like that idea. And my last interview was actually with Lester Brown, Plan B 4.0. And my guess is he would not disagree with you.
That's probably right. Yep. You know. Yeah, I like him. I like what he's doing.
Yeah. Someone else who has a global perspective.
That's
another thing I want to touch on here. You founded and still work half-time, you say, at the Global Business Network. What is the Global Business Network, and how has that changed over the years?
Global Business Network basically took scenario planning, which was created by Herman Kahn way back when, grabbed most productively by Royal Dutch Shell in England. And they got interested in how organizations learn and brought me in to run a series of conferences for them. Some of the people there left after 5 years or so and started a scenario planning consulting and research group in San Francisco called Global Business Network. So I was one of five co-founders. And it's amazing, but 20-plus years later, we're still in business. All the founders are still friends. And we got blended into a larger company called Monitor. And things are great. Scenario planning was kind of a new and revolutionary way to think about planning ahead back then, and now is pretty much the standard, and we get to be the standard bearer.
Yeah, I've had Peter Schwartz on here.
There you are. Peter Schwartz is the core of that.
Yeah, and then if one wants an early work of theirs, Seven Tomorrows.
Oh, yeah. Boy, that dates back.
I mean, it really dates back, and I noticed Paul Hawken was one of them as well. I mean, it was a pretty hot group that wrote that. It's a thin book, and it's basically looking ahead. I must say, before we go on, that when I often ask guests to really look ahead, I find it's one of the hardest things for people. Even big thinkers. It seems that being able to look, you know, this problem, this next step, that seems to be something people can do. But to really look kind of from the future, I find very tough.
Well, one of the things I've discovered, because I've been working with scenarios long enough, I start to look at what are their limitations. And one of their limitations is they're good basically out about 50 years. And then the world starts to be so far in many directions that, you know, to do four scenarios, which is the standard, just doesn't cut it. And you have to do another kind of thinking. And that's indeed one of the reasons I started the Long Now Foundation with Danny Hillis. To take 10,000 years, the next 10,000 years, and the last 10,000 years is the time frame we want to work in. And boy, do scenarios not work in that time frame.
Yeah, that was one of the next things I was going to say, that this Long Now Foundation, the book, The Clock of the Long Now, you've said a little bit about what it is. It's this idea to really look at the long term. Anything else that...
Well, it's I think we assume, I see some reason to believe that it's true that if people get comfortable thinking long-term, responsible behavior comes as a sort of a byproduct of that. And so we're trying to various hacks and tricks to make people comfortable with the long-term. The one that Danny Hillis came up with is to design a quite serious, quite beautiful, quite monumental 10,000-year clock that can keep very good time. That would be something inside a mountain in eastern Nevada that, you know, takes a day to visit it, and hopefully your mind will be a little different by the time you visit. Finished going up the mountain through the clock, see the bristlecone pines, come back down. So it's meant to be a kind of a quest, I suppose.
So a ritual that will immerse you in the consciousness, maybe.
Yeah, the best kind of ritual, where it's really tough and not everybody can make it. And so one of the things we're learning is we're the top of the mountain we're in is 11,600 feet. Not everybody's comfortable at that height. The trees are, but the people aren't.
Right.
So that's kind of there, and we're swarming ahead with building that clock. But then at the same time, we realized you can take on other problems from that time frame. We've got a project called the Rosetta Disk, which is collecting all the documented languages in the world. There's about 4,000 of them. We have most of them now. We're collecting the major elements that linguists like to have about a language, putting them on a very permanent storage form. In fact, one of them is on its way now to a comet, where it can stay in orbit that comet for a very long time. And it's a peculiar thing. There are a lot of people working in languages, and we're losing languages rapidly in the world. in the same area that we're losing species, we're losing languages often for the same reason. And so collecting these languages while we still have them, because each language is a reality. This is a John Brockman
concept. A worldview.
It's a worldview. It's, there's a vast amount of knowledge expressed and compressed in any given language. So keeping those, keeping access to them, and basically providing a what you would call platform-free way to associate the languages with one another over the centuries and millennia, we wound up, you know, going to the forefront of scholarship on this because nobody had tried to collect all the documented languages in one place together. That's the kind of thing that, you know, taking on this long-term frame of reference gets you involved in, and that's, it just keeps happening.
Yeah. A wonderful book on that subject that that may have nothing to do with what you've done is Light at the Edge of the World by Wade Davis.
Wade Davis is fantastic. I'm having him come and speak in our series in a couple months.
Very good. Yeah. So, I mean, and people who that subject interests you, check out his book. It's both, it contains his photographs from about 25 years and plus one culture after another that's dying or languages that are dying.
He's one of the great storytellers, but it's because he's one of the great adventure havers.
Yeah. Explorer in Residence at National Geographic, which is one of the great job titles I've ever heard of.
And he's the guy who figured out that zombies are really about something.
Oh, right, with Haiti and,
yeah,
and voodoo.
Yeah. Yeah, he's Mr. Voodoo.
Yeah, the serpent. I forget the full name of the
serpent.
The
Serpent in the Rainbow,
yeah,
probably.
Yeah. And he holds one of those people who speaks in paragraphs.
Uh-huh. Yep.
Which always blows my mind. let me just tell people who I'm speaking with. I'm Terry McNally, and I'm speaking with Stuart Brand. His new book, which we will get to in a few moments, is called Whole Earth Discipline, an Eco-Pragmatist Manifesto, and it challenges a lot of long-standing green attitudes that may have been inspired by his earlier The Whole Earth Catalog in 1968. I did want to, because I love giving people resources, something I only learned about in researching this is that people can still access your Global Business Network book club if they go to the GBN.com website. What are they likely to find there?
It's interesting that the ideal book club, in my view, when we started GBN, is a book club that doesn't offer you a choice of titles that you might get this discount or something like that. Just send me the damn book. So every month, we would send two books to all of the members, the extended members. We've got to be several hundred, the Global Business Network. And it was my job to do two things. One, to select the books, and then to do very short reviews and then excerpts from the book, similar to what I did in Whole Earth Catalog, actually. And, in fact, I do some of that in the new book. And the way I wanted to, the review was to let any person know whether, I mean, the people who are part of the network are always about to get on a plane and go somewhere. And what they want to know, is this a book that I should put in my briefcase and read on the plane or put on the shelf and think about later? So I try to give in four or five sentences the information they would need to make that decision.
Okay. And so that's what's up there. And it's from 20 years or so?
No, it's a period of maybe 10 years or so.
Okay.
So, you know, times 12.
But if you're liking the tenor of this conversation and you figure, what kind of books is this kind of guy going to point me to? That's at GBN.com. Okay. The Whole Earth Catalog.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to read. It implied an ideal of human progress that depended, and see if you agree with me, on decentralized, personal, liberating technological development, what was called by you or by others at that point, soft technology.
Right.
Now, that notion correct at that time, and what's changed?
Mainly the Whole Earth Catalog was about empowering and freeing individuals, and all of the tools in there basically were probably the maximum size would be a family or political group. Because of the scale of especially the climate problem, but other issues going on environmentally now, individuals are still extremely important. There's lots of people covering that, the things that you can do with recycling, with solar, with insulation, all that good stuff. What I'm not satisfied with is the quality of thinking about aggregate behavior and aggregate effects, which is what climate is made of. Basically, all 6.8 billion of us are responsible for what's happening with climate, and it's probably going to take a fair majority of that number of people doing the right thing to fix the problem. And so I'm, in a way, I was not, back in those days, I'm interested in what governments do. Because one of the problems with energy is that coal is cheap. It's the cheapest way to make baseload electricity. And coal is what's putting, James Hansen calls them factories of death. It is what is putting the major portion of the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which is making the climate change. So at that scale, what fixes that? And that's part of what I'm trying to address in the book, is just to work down from, that's what I mean, the whole Earth, I really mean it this time. You know, it really is not just decorative.
Right.
The climate problem is a whole Earth problem. The demographics of the world, where the 5 out of 6 people live in the developing world. They are really developing. I mean, they're moving fast. They're moving into the cities. They're getting some money. They're moving up the protein ladder. They're moving up the energy ladder toward more and more electricity. I've just been in Vietnam and Cambodia, and what I know is people who are moving from motor scooters toward cars, they are all going to get air conditioning. The global south is hot, of course, and it's going to be like Phoenix, and with the kind of energy demands that Phoenix or Fort Lauderdale or whatever has. That means a lot more than solar, a lot more than wind. These are poor people by and large, so when we talk conservation and efficiency, being poor means you are right down there at the core of not using much material, not using much energy, not using much food, and recycling everything. They don't want to stay there. And I don't feel like anybody can say you should stay there because that's so nice and green and you know, don't make a move. I mean, you can say it all you want. They're going to do what they're going to do. So looking at that scale of all of these issues, that's what this book is about.
Okay. At the global scale of the problem calls for global solutions, and so this book is at that level.
Yeah. And so I'm saying governments, one of the things, Whole Earth Catalog was sort of a libertarian Bible. This was in the era shortly after Kennedy asked now what your country can do for you, and we said, do it yourself. And just, put the country, we said.
Not saying to the country do it yourself, but we can do it ourselves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ask now what your country can do for you. You just go ahead and do whatever it is you
want.
Yeah,
right. Don't even ask.
Yeah, don't even ask. We left government out of the equation. We left politics out of the equation. We left art out of the equation. It was all pretty much
for the most part,
what works. So that was pragmatic, and this book is pragmatic. But this book engages government, engages the issue of how do you make coal expensive? Because so long as it's cheap, it's going to be what gets burned by everybody. And who runs economies these days is governments. I don't think there's a market solution to the fact that coal is cheap, because that's how come we got so much coal coming out of the ground and going into the atmosphere. And for governments to change their minds, it's pretty easy for China to change their mind.
Right.
It's run by engineers.
Yeah, let me just share. When I interviewed Jared Diamond.
Ah, good.
About
he's fantastic. He's pro-nuclear, by the way.
Oh, is he?
Yeah.
Okay. About collapse, of course.
Right.
And he talked about how when the floods in China a few years ago affected, I think, 250,000 people.
Yeah, that's classic China.
And $30 billion, but 250,000 people, they decided no more deforestation. And
right.
As we chatted, easy to do in China. No lumber lobby to deal with.
Right.
No have to pay off the senator from this province or that, and sort of the beauty of dictatorship when...
It's not just that it's an autocracy, though there's reason to believe that they're going to do pretty well, especially in Asia. Singapore is pretty much an autocracy, and it's one of the best governments in the world. And they're the ones who are being imitated probably more than us by various developing countries, because, we say, you got to have a bicameral legislature and this, that, and the other thing. And they're going, but can we make things happen fast? We got cities that are growing 9 times faster than European cities ever did. How are we supposed to stay ahead of that? And they look at places like Singapore and China. The other major difference to me is that almost all of the people in the senior positions in China have a training in engineering and science. They're not lawyers. And as a consequence, they can recognize scientific stuff, not get all tangled up in, was Darwin right or wrong or stuff like this, but just look at what is the data that's coming in, what are the theories that seem to explain the data, what do we do as engineers? Engineers are always looking for a way to fix a problem. And I wound up kind of valorizing engineers in this Whole Earth Discipline book, because that's the approach you want, is that, we're starting to understand the problem. Let's mess with it until we understand it better and then start down the road toward fixing it. And that's the Chinese approach. God knows they got problems. You know, the air is barely breathable. I was in Hanoi recently, and all that coal dust is coming over from China, and you can go to these scenic places, you can't see the scenery.
Mm-hmm. So they can change, but it's turning.
They have reason to change, and they move quickly.
Yeah.
And what I'm hearing from people who deal with them a lot is that climate was not really on their radar 10 years ago, started to be about 5 years ago, and now it's absolutely at the forefront. And whether or not we do stuff, China is moving ahead on trying to get ahead of climate issues.
Right, and they do it in all sorts of ways. Right?
Do it in all sorts of ways, and but it's tricky because, you know, they still are opening coal-fired plants.
Right, that's what I was going to say. It's talk about turning an aircraft carrier. I mean, it's an aircraft carrier only moving faster than an aircraft carrier.
Plus the, you know, we think of it as a hierarchy, and I think it's one of those things where there is a certain clarity coming out of the government in Beijing, but that doesn't necessarily get into a strict command form all the way down to the grassroots. And the grassroots are going to do what they're going to do, and then they argue.
Yeah. You mentioned Hoyler Catalog aimed at individuals, small groups, and so on. Now talking about governments and the actions of governments, where do the multinational corporations fit into this? Because, I mean, one could certainly say in this country, for instance, if you looked at the last 6 months, is the government in charge or are they?
I have the peculiar experience through Global Business Network of having worked with a lot of corporations. And Royal Dutch Shell, I was actually on their payroll for a few months while I was learning what their world was like. And I think, you know, there's sort of a corporations are good from one political standpoint, and another political group says, no, corporations are bad. They're all bad. And I think it's pretty much like saying, well, nations are bad. There's good ones, there's bad ones. They have good years, bad years. They have good leaders,
or
bad leaders.
Weather is bad.
Something like, well, yeah. it's a little more specific and organizational than that.
Yeah.
I think the best way to deal with corporations is really on a case-by-case basis. That is, on a corporation, a situation, a technology, a political issue, who's doing what in relation to that particular issue. I think this is maybe the fundamental message I'm trying to get across is that pragmatism doesn't work out of ideology at all. It doesn't work out of these grand theories of corporations or this or corporations or that. Is working on, you know, what actually would work best under the circumstances that we're looking at right now. And are there frames of thinking about it that are not ideological in the sense of these big simple stories, but are theories that, you know, actually show signs of working over time rather than just being comforting? And so it's an endless process. It's like science. It is an endless debate. It is an endless negotiation with reality.
Endless refinement, endless experimentation.
And, you know, when you get something that works, roll it out.
Yeah.
And if you're bumping your head against something, back off a little ways and move a little ways to the left or right and then try again. So that approach, I think, is going to be more broadly taken in context of how weird stuff is getting, how quickly with climate. My fellow environmentalists deserve all the credit in the world for pushing ahead with climate is a problem that was going to be quite consequential, and they began by understanding it well, but I think got used to being right about that and have yet to realize it's much more serious than we thought. And if James Lovelock is right, we are headed toward a 5 degrees Celsius warmer climate, which would be a carrying capacity for maybe 1.5 billion of us.
Okay, we're going to go to a break, but let me just say what he just said. James Lovelock, the fellow who came up with the Gaia hypothesis, he says he sees inevitable a 5%? I mean, 5 degree?
That's, yeah.
Or likely?
He's putting it as inevitable.
Okay.
I'm not as persuaded as he is, but he knows a lot.
But we're quoting him right now. 5 degrees, and you're saying that if that becomes so, that gives the Earth a carrying capacity of about 1.5 billion people as we're moving toward 9.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
So the difference between 9 billion and 1.5 billion is a lot of people not being killed by climate, but killing each other over, you know, drastically reduced resources.
It isn't climate change itself. The seas will kill some who live close to the seas, they'll take care of a few island civilizations. But you're saying it's when the carrying capacity drops that mankind reverts to warfare.
Drought basically is what gets you. Drought has taken down most of the civilizations that we've watched disappear looking back through history. And, you know, a 10-year drought you can sort of handle. But when it goes much longer than that, one, if it's over 10 years, that tells you it's probably a climate effect, which could be quite long-lasting. And you just can't recover from that. I mean, if we get 5 degrees warmer, the rainforests will disappear like the ice is disappearing now. They basically get replaced by scrub or savanna. And, you know, we lose a zillion species. The rainforest basically keeps itself going by making its own rain, making its own clouds, brightening the planet, all of that. And when you lose that, it really is gone for quite a while. So agriculture would move toward the poles. People would move toward the poles. There's not that much land toward the poles, especially in the global south. There's a lot of people in the global south. And so you're already looking at, are starting to be referred to as environmentally failed states. You would be looking at massive climate refugees, resource wars of the sort we've seen in Darfur. And one of the fundamental things going on with Darfur is the farmers and the pastoral folks with their herds moving through used to like each other and, you know, use the same water. And then there got to be less water and they started killing each other. That's what happens when you have less of whatever it is that you're trying to deal with, water or food or these various things, space to live. Depending on the speed of the change, and there's reasons to think that some of this stuff happens very rapidly because of positive feedback like we saw with the ice. The ice by the IPCC scenario is going to melt seriously by about 2040, and it melted seriously in 2007. What happened, part of it was this positive feedback of reflective ice turning into dark absorbent water, which then gets warmer and makes even less ice, which makes even more water absorbing even more heat, and that's positive feedback. There's a lot of mysteries in climate. I would love to have some hidden negative feedback, some hidden stabilities.
Some self-correcting things that,
some
that
self-correcting
just show
things.
Up.
Yeah. And they might. Well, I love doing the research on this because I kept coming across news. One piece of news to me was that, unfortunately, we're still cutting down quite a lot of primary rainforest in the world and turning it into pasture and whatnot. But 55 times more than we're cutting down is growing back as second growth as people are moving to the cities all over the tropics. And that's a fantastic number. There's a mystery sink of carbon that's coming out of the atmosphere that the present models don't explain. We're not sure if it's going into the oceans, going into the continents, or where. It may well be partly going into this second growth that's growing back. So I wind up with one of my messages in the book is that cities are probably the greenest thing that humanity does.
Okay, let's talk about that, because what your book, the Whole Earth Discipline, does is it sets up the crisis and the stakes,
mm-hmm.
and then you kind of look at sort of four big issue areas.
Right.
Urbanization, geoengineering, nuclear, and biotechnology,
mm-hmm.
right? Not in that order, but those are the four big. So let's move into that then. On the urbanization,
mm-hmm.
you say every week 1.3 million new people, 70 million a year, arrive in cities. Okay, every week, 1.3 million. Hear that? The world population as a whole is surpassing 50% urban, and it was 14% in 1900. And the growth of cities is leading demographic trends exactly the opposite of what many experts have predicted. What is that?
Well, one of the things that was a flip with the demographers and economists at the United Nations about 20 years ago is they had always been treating the squatter cities and slums, where a billion people now live in the world, as a disaster. And, you know, architects would go in and try to make better housing and things like this. But then they sent out 30-some economic teams to go just hang out in the slums, in the squatter cities, and they came back with these kind of half smiles, saying, you know, that's kind of great. These people are not crushed by poverty. They are getting themselves out of poverty as fast as they possibly can, and they're doing it very, very quickly. One of the side effects is that women get liberated when they move to the village into town. They immediately start having fewer children. They're not under the thumb of the tradition of the village or the family elder or whatever. And they start, you know, they're the ones that you want to loan money to. They're more reliable for these microloans.
Let me interrupt you for a second. So this thing, which has become, you know, knowledge over the last how many years, decades, that the education of women, the liberation of women, the advancement of women is what is going to save us,
yeah.
if anything. You're saying that urbanization wasn't planned that way, but that's what happens.
Each individual family plants it that way. I mean, they are leaving, to a large extent, a subsistence farming situation where they don't get to participate in the cash economy because they're just growing their own food. It's a tremendously fragile way to live. A side effect, so they go toward opportunity, toward jobs, toward a better chance at education, medical care, all this kind of stuff, which is all in town. They leave behind now a fallow subsistence farm, which very quickly, especially in the tropics, the trees come back, the wild animals come back, the water comes back, the soil comes back. All of that's good stuff for the, you know, the ecosystem services that we talk about, the natural infrastructure that I would call it. And so these nations are getting ecologically healthier as people move to town. Same thing happens in the developed world. And indeed, in the developed world, we're now about 80% urban. That's what we are in the U.S., Canada, and so on. And all the trends are that's what's happening in the developing world by mid-century. So, you know, you've got the population gain, you've got the ecological gain, you've got enormous energy gains in the developed world when people move into the city, get themselves compressed. I was just in Manhattan and, you know, of the developing world, Manhattan's probably as green as anywhere. So all of that is good news, plus people are having a good time.
And when you say having a good time, what you're talking about is, I've seen you put up in your TED Talk.
Uh-huh.
And if people, we've talked about TED Talks here before, you know, if you go to TED.com, it is .com, isn't it?
Yeah. Probably.
Yeah. And just look up Stuart. He's got a few of them, but the one on cities, you have this slide that says this is what the village was, and this is what the city is. And it has a lot to do with energy, excitement, possibility, innovation, all those things which we may say, oh, but they're losing their link with the natural world. In fact, as you say about the Whole Earth Catalog, you say a lot of people read it, and they read Mother Earth, and they went to the commune in the country. And they lasted 6 months, a year.
Right, yeah.
And they've been the high-powered executives that have taken us into where we are now.
It's interesting. The women were the first to leave the communes. And then the men didn't last long enough.
After that, no.
And in a sense, you know, I think it was a great experiment that we did with the communes in the 60s and the early 70s. And most people did bounce out of it. We learned a lot. And for me, it made me feel deeply good about cities, and that may have given me part of the frame of reference to discover that everybody was discovering this about cities. It's a renaissance. That's what the renaissance was.
The first time.
In Europe was a reurbanization of Europe after the 1,000 years of darkness and nobody taking a bath following the fall of Rome.
Many believe that globalization, which drives families from subsistence farming in rural settings to poverty in urban centers, is a painful price that these individual human beings are paying for societal change. That there was a way that they could feed themselves, boom, cancel that one, not replaced, they're in trouble. And your answer to that?
Famines now are always rural. There's not been famines in cities for quite a while. So if you want to be sure of food, get the hell out of the country and get into town. That's what people are discovering all over the place. The problem with subsistence farming is, one, it's a hell of a lot of work. It's truly backbreaking and boring as hell. It's beautiful in many respects. I mean, some of the ancient villages in India have been there for hundreds, maybe thousands of years, and there's a sense of belonging there that is profound. But, boy, is there no opportunity. You are stuck. And, you know, you're going to marry one of three or four potential people that are of your age and of the right genetic distance and all of that. And that's it. And that may or may not be somebody you really want to live with all your life, but, sorry, that's the choice. You go and visit an uncle in town and meet some people, see you can get some work, actual cash, significantly more money than you could get back in the village. And, you know, you light out for not the territory, you light out for the bright lights. that is something that many countries immediately had these huge cities that the national government was saying, we can't handle this. Please stay back. Everybody stay back in the country, and we're going to force you to stay back in the country. If people are leaving the countryside on their own and going to really tough slums, you have to wonder, you know, how bad was it where they just were that they would go to that tough slum completely on their own and against all kinds of pressures from the national government. And with, you know, occasional
and against blood. Tradition in their own and their family
traditions and so on, and you know, and they get bulldozed and all the rest of it. But it is the case that the love of the village, the love of the land that they grew up on, is intact, as I understand it. Everybody remembers where they come from. If they can get back there from time to time, visit the relatives, they do. And I think over the course of time, as developing countries become developed countries, that love of that land will keep people connected, will help protect the natural systems as they go back, having had more opportunity with more money, more education, more capability of really taking on environmental issues. It could lead to a fantastic long-term greening of the somewhat ravished countryside in a lot of these places.
Let me give you a quick incident that happened, and I think it fits what you're saying, but I was in Bali.
Ah.
And Bali, of all the countries I visited, well, island, it's not a country, but that part of Indonesia, I saw for most of my 10 or 15 days there, no poverty, no shanties, no, and I'd seen it everywhere else. Hmm. As I'm driving to the airport to leave, to Denpasar, I say to my driver, as we pass some poverty, uh-huh. some clear, uh-huh. you know, I went, wow, I haven't seen that before in Bali. And he said this one sentence, there are no villages in Denpasar. In other words, to him, uh-huh. you couldn't see that kind of poverty in a village, but you could as you move into urbanization. Now, however, this is someone who makes a living driving a car.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And where was he when he was growing up? I haven't been to Bali. I'd love to go. I tell a long Balinese story in this book about the incredible thousand-year-old rice culture irrigation system that they have that is one of the finest examples of managing the commons, as it's called, in the world. And I was actually delighted to see that a Nobel Prize went to Eleanor Ostrom, who is the managing the commons woman this year.
Yeah. That was an advance on two grounds, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was finally a woman, and finally the commons got...
Well, and finally a social scientist. She's not an economist. She got the economy prize.
So, let me ask one other thing on that, and then we'll move on. I have read, you can read a lot of things, but I've read that individuals who move, I think this was specifically people who move from small villages, poverty in villages in Mexico, move to Los Angeles or San Diego, that in fact, I don't know how they've done the research, but that psychologically and emotionally, more issues once they're in the urban poverty than mm-hmm. when they were in the village poverty.
Mm-hmm.
How does that fit what you're saying? If true.
Yeah, my ignorance falls over this subject like a wet blanket. I really don't know that material at all. It's interesting to me. I've run into a number of quite really deeply talented and capable Mexicans working in California. And some are making a home here, and many others are heading the hell back.
That's right. They come, they earn some money, they go back.
And presumably that's good for Mexico. It's like remittances. It is a large moving of money from a wealthy area to a less wealthy area, and that's good news as far as I'm concerned. But I love the clarity of both sets of people that I've run into. The ones who are headed back to Mexico, they got no doubts about that at all. The ones who are making a home here are very comfortable with that. So, small sample there, but
right.
Boy, do I admire these characters.
Yeah. Let's move to the nuclear issue.
Mm-hmm.
I saw you at Bioneers 2 years ago debate your longtime friend and colleague Peter Warshall about nuclear energy.
Uh-huh.
You went first and made the case that whatever else we do, we need a lot of either coal or nuclear,
mm-hmm.
primarily for base load, which I'll let you explain. And nuclear is far superior to coal, especially when it comes to climate change, right? So
right.
Let's get busy. One of the keys to your argument is that renewables are weak when it comes to baseload. As I recall, Warshall countered by saying that all that changes when we move from centralized power grids to decentralized interactive power generation, and that while your argument has been true, the future is different.
Well, what's fun is the best decentralized source of power now is these micro reactors that are coming along. You know, Al Gore has been saying, well, the problem with nuclear power is it comes in only one size, extra large, and that's no longer the case. There's about 12 different models that I know and several private companies that are making very serious, very productive reactors that are 1/64th the size of the big iron that, you know, Areva and Westinghouse and so on are building. These are down around 25 to 100 megawatts. You can run a whole town, a small town, on one of these things, and you can gang a couple of them together and run a pretty large town. They can, because they're buried in the ground, you basically stick them, they're built in a factory, trucked in, trained in, stuck in the ground, leave them there for 30 or 60 years, swap out a new one or swap in some fuel. Or in one case, there's the thorium reactor that you just leave it right there when you're done. That's where the what's left is going to stay. All of these have exactly this decentralized micropower quality to them that Pierre Warshall on that occasion was lauding. And he's right. That is a much more resilient system. It is the case, and it's one of the things that I really appreciate Amory Lovins drawing attention to, which is that most of the failures that we have in our sources of electricity is not in the plants, but in the grid and in the way the grid is managed. And so we hear that, you know, if there's been a blackout somewhere, it's not because some power source went off. It's because the transmission lines got the way the electricity was moved around got screwed up. Here in California, we had huge events with that, obviously. So decentralizing is a good thing, and nuclear can be in the thick of that.
So what you're saying is, and because we've covered so much territory, we're going through this pretty quickly, but that I think Amory, who I've read on this subject, says efficiency number one.
Absolutely, I agree.
Decentralize, and this back and forth between wherever there's a solar, you know, wherever someone's generating solar, when they're not using it, it can go back into the grid.
Solar's very good at decentralized.
Et cetera, wind and so on. So efficiency, decentralization, you say yes to both, but there's a gap, and that gap is either time or total energy needed that will need to be filled by either coal or nuclear, and nuclear is your choice.
And I think we're still learning what the trade-offs are. To do a gigawatt is a billion watts. That's a normal, fairly large-size nuclear reactor. To do a gigawatt of wind is about 250 square miles of wind farm. It's about 50 square miles of bulldozed landscape for solar. And that's a serious trade-off.
You know, now,
as an environmentalist, I have to freak out. You know, there's talk of bulldozing 1,000 square miles of Southern California for these solar farms.
Now, they wouldn't be the only thing necessarily there, certainly, especially with wind.
Well, yeah, wind is, you know, they're fun to visit, and the cows don't seem to mind too much, but, you know, you don't want to hang out underneath these wind farms too long. It is just too noisy and strange, and it's not a place, you know, you've got a lot of oil wells in Los Angeles. I don't think
they
have a lot of wind farm right around where people are. But maybe I'm wrong. Gavin Newsom wants to put them all over San Francisco. We'll see if people actually like that.
So, in other words, what you're saying is I can show you a scenario in which farmers continue to farm between their wind turbines. They're
right.
400 feet high wind turbines. But
right.
What you're saying is they're going to have some very big earplugs.
Something like. And, you know, you can imagine plenty of row crops. You can imagine, and we're already seeing it, plenty of pasture underneath these things. And that's fine. It's a good thing. It's a second source of income for the farmers if they're in a windy area. Another aspect of this, though, is that the wind is typically in a different place than where the people are. And so you've got these very long transmission lines and with the losses and all the things that go with that.
There's a reason people didn't settle where the wind was highest.
Yeah, it's, you know, it gets old pretty fast.
Okay, so what you're seeing then is what you foresee and what you're urging is a mix, but put nuclear back in the mix.
Right.
The arguments I see, the two primary are, of course, what do we do with the waste?
Right. That one's completely settled technically, but obviously not settled politically.
Mm-hmm. And How is it settled technically, and why is it not settled politically? Why doesn't the fact that it's settled technically matter?
That's interesting. That's a good question. The technical solution has been around for a long time. Well, there's two levels of the technical solution. Yucca Mountain became a big argument, and finally Obama took it off the table, and that's fine as far as I'm concerned. I've been there. It's kind of interesting, but I've just soon stopped the argument because it was an expensive one. What has been done instead with nuclear waste in the U.S. and pretty much everywhere else in the world is you stick it in this dry cask storage and stand the casks out back of the parking lot.
Of the power.
Of the various reactors.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, because we can't agree on where to put it, so let's leave it here.
Leave it here. Turns out that's a perfectly good place to put it. You can go out there, have yourself photographed standing next to it. No bad thing is going to happen to you. The casks are really stable for 100, 200 years while we think about this stuff, because we may want to reprocess it, recycle it. We may want to feed it to the next generation, generation four reactors that run much hotter and could use that waste as direct fuel. Or we may want to toss it in the ground somewhere. And Finland is already building a geological repository for some of their nuclear waste. We've had one that's running for 10 years now in New Mexico called the WIP, the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant. Down in a salt formation, which is 3,000 foot thick. They go down in the middle of it, half a mile from the surface, stick this stuff in there. It's all military nuclear waste. And that formation runs for hundreds of miles in various directions. It has been where it is for 250 million years. No water gets in, no water gets out. It's not going anywhere. It's not on any tectonic plate or anything like that. Once you enter geological time, which is what you do when you put something down in a place like that, worrying about whether something's half-life might last 10,000 years or longer really disappears. That's what I mean by the technical solution for stashing it at a geological place has really been solved. To the question of why it's not solved politically, we have an irrational, weird relationship to the idea of radioactivity that I think is mainly a byproduct of the end of World War II and Hiroshima and Nagasaki. To the point, and it was amazing misunderstandings, some of which my fellow environmentalists have helped purvey, so that when Chernobyl happened, in which 57 people died, 9 of them children from a thyroid cancer, and mostly these rather heroic workmen who tried to control the damage. But there were thousands of abortions had all over that part of Europe because the women were afraid that they were going to have monsters as a result of a little bit of extra radioactivity. Well, there was never, even from Hiroshima and Nagasaki, there was no congenital birth defects that resulted from that, and certainly none that came out of Chernobyl. So it's all based on fear of radiation that we've helped reinforce that is based on no facts. And so that's why I think that you've got this pretty strong emotional panicky thing that goes on around this stuff. I think that climate is going to change the frame of reference on that, but I've gotten to the point, I used to be anti-nuclear, kind of knee-jerk, and as I got into this with climate, got some more understanding of the material, now I'm pretty pro-nuclear, to the point where if climate was not an issue, if greenhouse gases were not an issue, I would still be pro-nuclear.
I'll tell you what, we're just about at the end. I'm really very close to the end. What I wanted to say was that I know that the other objection to nuclear is cost.
Right.
And we don't have time to go into that.
Right, right.
So, and that's where the debates are not, they're not just emotional. There's, you know, lots of numbers being thrown around, but there are some people who say it just never is going to compete, and some people who say it's fine already. We can't even go into that. But the book is the Whole Earth Discipline, an Eco-Pragmatist Manifesto. What you can hear is that Stuart Brand, someone who obviously has thought a lot about culture, society, survival, the environment, all of that, art, as everything from art to engineering, is taking his big look. That's what I see this book as, is that, you know, as I said, you're in your 70s, you looked at the big picture, and this is where you stand today. And so it's definitely worth reading. Let me tell people that we'll be on again next week. The book is The Whole Earth Discipline. The website that he suggests is sbnotes.com. Thank you, Stuart Brand. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, Terrence.